first from Mr. Fletcher's. Fletcher's. Whenever you're ready.
Please the court. My name is Brandon Fletches. I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, in this case Gregory Brooks, who brings this appeal from the Northern District of Mississippi and seeks de novo review of the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the defense on the basis of qualified immunity. There are three claims currently before this court on appeal: an arrest without probable cause claim, a First Amendment retaliation claim, and an excessive force claim. On the claims of arrest without probable cause and First Amendment retaliation, we ask this court to rule that the officers' actions were objectively unreasonable and that they violated plaintiff's clearly established rights. On the claim of excessive force, we ask this court to rule that there are sufficient, genuinely disputed issues of material fact to deny defendant's motion for summary judgment and present that issue to a jury. Turning first to the First Amendment claim, this is a unique case from a First Amendment perspective because in this case we have direct evidence of retaliatory motive. The defendants have been given no fewer than three opportunities to fully explain the basis for the arrest of Mr. Brooks. First, in the affidavit. And the affidavit states, and I'll quote, "Mr. Brooks did willfully and unlawfully said to Officer Birchfield to get his punk ass off his property. And when he was told to come down, he said, 'I told you to get your mother effing ass off my land.'" The affidavit is based entirely upon speech. The second chance was in the officer's reports. Mr. Brooks' conduct is described in Officer Birchfield's report as follows. "Mr. Brooks said to me that he did not like what I said, and he wanted me to get my punk ass off his property. That's why Tim Brinkley demoted your ass. I told Mr. Brooks to come down. He said, 'I don't like you anyway, Jimmy Birchfield, and I told you to get your mother effing ass off my land, you mother effer. You tried to talk to my wife anyway.' That's when I told Mr. Brooks he was under arrest for disorderly conduct." And of course, the third opportunity to fully explain why they arrested Mr. Brooks was at the officer's depositions. And I won't go through the entire deposition in every instance in which Officer Birchfield did state that the arrest was based upon speech. But I will say for the record that at page 738 of the record, when plainly asked the basis of his arrest, Officer Birchfield stated, "The basis of the arrest was Mr. Brooks saying cuss words towards Officer Birchfield, even after being told not to." Should I continue, Your Honor?
Yes, go ahead.
With all of that, we should have sufficient evidence of retaliatory motive for the arrest. So, in this circuit, unlike some other circuits, even when there is direct evidence of retaliatory motive, you still have to show a lack of probable cause in order to carry a claim. That's recognized under Keenan versus Tejada. So we turn now to the issue of probable cause. In Mississippi, the law is clear. In order to establish probable cause to make an arrest for disorderly conduct, an officer must have sufficient evidence to believe that a breach of the peace is being threatened or a crime is about to occur. We stand here 3 years after this arrest, after time for affidavits, reports, depositions, briefing, and a summary judgment motion, and now briefing on an appeal. The defense has still never said what Mr. Brooks was doing to breach the peace or what Mr. or what crime Mr. Brooks was feared to commit if he was not arrested. Further, they have never actually been able to point out, and there's none in the record, any actual conduct that would rise above the level of speech prior to the initiation of the arrest.
Prior to the initiation of the arrest, right?
Yes, Your Honor. So it has
it's sort of poke holes in this version of it. It's an unusual case and difficult for me in that I think it's undisputed that Brooks calls the police to his own home. They do come and he does cuss them, although it's disputed what cuss words he uses. Then in that two-part event or single integral event, he exits suddenly from the side door, right? And then there's this physical confrontation that I think would have to be the arrest moment. During that scuffle, it's undisputed that he resisted to some extent. So when you look at the undisputed facts as that, he calls cops to come, then he cusses at cops, then they say come out, he comes out quickly, fearfully, eyes big, thinks that Iraqis are around, and at that point, they do arrest him. So it would seem to me that the analysis, at least that the district court conducted, I admit there's different testimony by the officers, the district court said that's disorderly conduct sufficient to allow the arrest. In other words, it's speech plus conduct, the conduct being coming out of the door quickly, simple assault, whatever you want to call it.
The first thing I'll do to poke holes in that, Your Honor, is the defendant's position has consistently been, until the district court brought up United States versus Tinkle and tried to make it applicable to this set of facts, it has consistently been that the arrest was initiated in the front yard.
Yeah, that's hard for me to see, and anyway, we're reviewing what the district court did. So the district court says he's arrested when Sergeant Birchfield, is that the one who wants to grab his hands but only ends up grabbing one? Is it Birchfield or is it Spaulding?
The facts of what happened after Mr. Brooks actually exits the house are disputed, heavily disputed. Would you like me to move to that portion?
To me that nut is the kernel of the district court ruling, which says that the probable cause that existed was for disorderly conduct. And Ramirez is a complicated case, and it's Texas law. So if we confine ourselves just to the moment between when they're at the front door knocking, he has this traumatic moment and comes out quickly from the side towards them, one might say that that's speech plus conduct that an officer then could arrest, and that is exactly what they then do. That's the first time they lay hands on him and restrict his movement, right?
Right. Well, then I would say, Your Honor, going to that moment, and I think it's hard to get past the defendant's position on where the arrest began. And I will say...
But where's his motion restricted prior to that?
Your Honor, and that's the issue. And that's the issue that was brought up in the appellee's brief that does not apply. There was no seizure in the front yard.
So then we don't need to worry about PC until there is a seizure.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay, why?
Because the arrest was initiated this gets to a situation where it's kind of what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If we look at Officer Birchfield's subjective intent in this.
But we don't do that.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, Your Honor. If we don't do that, we look at what an objective officer would do. Well, the same for Mr. Brooks. We look at what a reasonable person would believe in his circumstance. And the reasonable person in his circumstance, having been told by Officer Birchfield, you're under arrest for disorderly conduct, would consider himself to be under arrest.
Now, what's your best authority for that? If the guy goes back in his own home, he thinks he's under arrest?
Well, again, that's going to the subjectivity of Mr. Brooks, not to whether a reasonable person would have believed they were under arrest.
But what case do you have that says a reasonable person would think they're under arrest even though the cop has left the property and he's gone back in his house?
Well, Your Honor,
there's none. Well, go play with me a little bit. If the arrest moment is the putting hands on, what's wrong with police officers thinking that they had probable cause when he came out of a different door quickly? And the testimony from his family is that he was in a very aggravated state and was cussing and approaching them swiftly, was the daughter's word.
There are issues with that.
Okay.
The first issue is the nature of the disorderly conduct charge itself. If you look at page 139-140 of the record, it is the dispatch log sheet. And if you look at those pages, from the time that Mr. Brooks, or the time that Officer Birchfield called dispatch and had obviously at least made the decision to arrest, from the time that Officer Spradling actually arrives at the scene, 6 minutes passed. In order to have probable cause to arrest someone for disorderly conduct, you have got to believe that they are about to breach the peace or commit a crime. It makes absolutely no sense on the disorderly conduct charge to allow 6 minutes to pass in which a person that you think is about to commit a crime, and allow 6 minutes to pass waiting on another officer to arrive, and then summon someone out of their home in order to arrest them for a disorderly conduct charge, which is a situational tool for police officers. It's a tool where police officers can inject themselves into a situation and give an order to prevent a breach of the peace or prevent the commission of a crime, to prevent escalation of a situation. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the officer's actions escalated the situation. In Mississippi, the court in Odom versus State put a duty on police officers, and that duty says law enforcement officers must attempt to calm situations instead of escalate them.
But in this case, I mean, I guess, do we have two separate situations? It seems like it was over with. He'd gone inside his house. The police officer went back to his squad car, but the officer determined that there'd been a violation, and so then you have the second encounter.
Well, here's the other issue with disorderly conduct. If you're looking at it as two separate encounters, there was never an order given, which Mr. Brooks disobeyed when he came out of the house. And in the case of Newman versus, I cited it on my 28J letter.
What do they say? The order could be twofold. Don't cuss at us, and you would say that has all sorts of problems under Mississippi law.
Absolutely.
The other would be calm down and come out.
The order was come out, and he came out.
Well, okay, they're at the front door, and he comes out the side.
Because they keep that door bolted. The order was come out.
What does the record reflect? Did they go to the front door when he first called them to come?
No, they were saying he met him in the front yard. And in fact, Officer Birchfield states at one point, well, I saw the wife and daughter come out of the front door. And then we pinned him down on that. And he said, well, no, I actually didn't see that because they came out of the side door and walked across the yard out to the street where his car was. Okay. Your Honor, respectfully, I keep my front door bolted.
You what?
And when someone knocks on the front door, I've either got to find a key or walk out my kitchen door and walk around our brick path to meet them in the front, which is what I do usually if someone does knock on the front door. That's not a crime. In the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and you said something interesting earlier when you said your job is to review what the district court did. This is a de novo review. You give no discretion to what the district court did or what they found. Looking at this record in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, what Mr. Brooks did was came out of his house. He was not obviously trying to ambush them, because he said, why the hell are you knocking on my door? He announced himself that he was coming. Now, the coming at us in a rage was added at the deposition. You'll notice that was not in the report. It was not in the affidavit. It certainly was not the basis for the arrest.
But the wife and daughter corroborate that.
Now, Your Honor, the wife and daughter corroborate that he moved quickly out of the house and then came around the corner. He was walking towards where the officers were. He said, why the hell are you banging on my door? If you look at Officer Spradling's report, he walks to Officer Spradling and stops. That's Officer Spradling's report. He walks to him and stops.
Your time's tight. You want to get to excessive force?
Excessive force basically boils down to there are disputed facts. And what it really is in the light most favorable to Mr. Brooks, which is what we have to view this record in, he came out, stopped at Officer Spradling. Officer Spradling put his hands behind his back. He demonstrated this in his deposition, put his hands behind his back, and then he is charged at by Officer Birchfield, and he puts his hands up to block Officer Birchfield's assault. And Officer Birchfield runs into Mr. Brooks' hands. So at the point
that
he
ends up on the ground.
Right. And that's an important point, Your Honor, because verbal commands went out the window after Officer Birchfield charged Mr. Brooks. And there was never get down. There was never, but neither officer
What's
says.
What's your best case that this level of force would be excessive? What's your closest case? Most of them are tasering and more. Here, if we assume there was PC to arrest and you acknowledge there was some resistance and his wife and daughter are saying, just calm down, get down. Well, they took him down. The injury, it would seem to me, would have to be his hospitalization for the PTSD. But correct me if I'm wrong. Does the record show that they knew he had PTSD?
No. They did not know.
Okay, go ahead.
The only reason to bring up PTSD is to try to get this court to draw inferences in their favor. The officers didn't know that.
But if they did know it, that would enhance your Graham factor case. If the officers knew he were vulnerable, well, it's a reasonable officer test anyway. What's your closest case in excessive force to these facts?
Newman versus Guidry, wherein this court stated that a plaintiff's refusal to fall down while force is being used against him was not active resistance under the Graham factors. And I think I did a fairly decent job of analyzing the Graham factors in my brief, where the district court did not analyze the Graham factors at all, just cited to the Graham factors and said this wasn't excessive force. Also very important in the excessive force and under Newman versus Guidry when looking at whether there was active resistance is that no verbal orders were given in the Newman versus Guidry case, and the court took that into account in finding that the plaintiff had not actively resisted.
Let me ask you this before you run out of time. What were the extent of the injuries? What are the injuries that your client sustained? Physically and mentally, are you seeking both?
We are seeking both, Your Honor.
And what were the physical injuries?
Back injury and neck injury, which is in the ER record, which is in the record. Would you like me to expand on that, or I'm out of time?
No, that's fine.
Sir. Mr. Montgomery.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court.
Yes.
Your Honor, my name is Lim Montgomery. I'm with Butler Snow, and together with my law partners, Margaret Smith and Kat Carrington, we represent the city of West Point, Mississippi, and officers Birchfield and Spradling, the defendants and appellees. Your Honor, we would start by pointing out, before I jump right into the facts, I know the court's well aware of this, the qualified immunity summary judgment standard, but just to reiterate it briefly, qualified immunity protects public officials from suit unless their conduct violates a clearly established right. Qualified immunity attaches as long as the officer's actions could reasonably have been thought consistent with the rights they're alleged to have violated. It protects all but the plainly incompetent and those who knowingly violate the law. And to defeat a claim of qualified immunity, there's the two-pronged test. There are two things the plaintiff must prove. Number one, that the official's conduct, the officer's conduct, violated a constitutional right. And two, that the official's actions were objectively unreasonable in light of clearly established law. At the summary judgment stage, which is where we come from for purposes of this appeal, the burden shifts to the plaintiff to come forward with proof, with evidence, that his constitutional rights were violated and that the officer's actions were unreasonable in light of clearly established law.
Disputing the rights, you have a right not to be arrested if there's no PC.
That is correct. The right
there, I mean, what is the Mississippi, he's asked over and over again, what is the Mississippi offense for which Brooks was arrested?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about speech, and I believe I heard the appellant's counsel say that the defendants have never been able to point to any conduct above speech.
What was the offense for which the officers had probable cause to arrest him?
The offense was shouting at the top of his lungs in close proximity to a uniformed police officer of the city of West Point, Mississippi, in an angered, irate, and belligerent, enraged demeanor and refusing to calm down and calm himself after being warned to do so by the officer.
Okay, that's a hard one for you to make. I mean, it is. Yeah, my line of questioning was different, and it may just show my ignorance, but it seems to me Mississippi is very clear, almost quoting verbatim, it is not illegal to taunt, insult. It may be dislikable behavior, but if you shout and yell insultingly, the Jones decision and Odom and whatever the third one is, Spellmacher, all seem to say without combative activity and conduct, that's not a crime. What's the crime? Profanity?
No, sir, not at all. I read the Odom case and the Sindelweck case differently, I suppose. The record as we see it, yeah, I took the plaintiff appellant's deposition myself, and I asked him after the part he admitted where he said, "Get the hell out of my yard," to Officer Birchfield. I asked, did you say anything else to Officer Birchfield? And his quote was, "I don't know if I said anything else to him or not. I was upset when he told me I couldn't press charges." Right. Officer Birchfield remembers the situation vividly and testified that he did continue to say more things to him.
Brooks said, "I did not use MF." He explicitly denies that.
Right, and it's not the words. The words are a little bit in dispute.
But what's the crime when you say shouting loudly? What is the crime?
It's the escalation.
No, not what escalation. What is the crime in the Mississippi Code?
Disorderly conduct.
Okay, so we've got and you don't dispute that the elements of disorderly conduct require that a particular order exist, and so therefore you would say the order here was can't cuss at me.
It was calm down.
Oh, that's the order.
It was calm down. Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. And I can cite you the record at 755. Birchfield testifies that he told Mr. Brooks to calm down. Mr. Brooks testified that he has no recollection about whether he was told that or not. So that is an undisputed fact testified to by Officer Birchfield that the plaintiff gives no conflicting testimony. So there is an order by the officer. It's undisputed there's an order to calm down, and yet Mr. Brooks continues to, and his words aren't the issue, it's his demeanor, his angered, irate, tempered demeanor in close, hand-to-hand, face-to-face proximity to a uniformed officer that constitutes disorderly conduct in the first encounter.
Well, should not have the arrest taken place immediately then when he did not calm down immediately? It seems to me that the situation had calmed down. He'd gone back to his house, inside his house, and the policeman had walked off. So could you say the instruction was complied with because the tense situation had calmed down?
Well, the undisputed testimony was that Officer Birchfield said, "Calm down or you can be arrested for disorderly conduct." And after that point, the plaintiff continued, Mr. Brooks continued to, the quotes were, scream at the top of his lungs. He escalated his anger. He was in a rage. He was irate and disorderly. So at that point, the crime of disorderly conduct in Birchfield's view had been committed already. And Birchfield testified that he gave the arrest order. Mr. Brooks, you are under arrest. Mr. Brooks has consistently maintained until appeal that he didn't perceive or hear any arrest order, and he walked into his home not believing he was under arrest. I believe the quote in paragraph 12 of the complaint and the amended complaint was, "At no time was Mr. Brooks told that he was under arrest or that he had broken any law." So it's our position, Your Honor, that in encounter number one, there is undisputed testimony by Officer Birchfield that pertains to the demeanor of Gregory Brooks and the escalation of anger in close proximity to the officer. And the question becomes, could the officer have reasonably believed at that point that a crime had been committed, that disorderly conduct had been committed? And it's our view that if Officer Birchfield could have paused the encounter and referenced the disorderly conduct statute and the conduct that was the subject of the Odom and the Sindelweck cases, that he and any reasonable officer would have carried out the arrest without hesitation. Odom and Sindelweck, the arrestee in those cases, the conduct is described almost identically. It's really lesser conduct than what's been testified to and not disputed by Gregory Brooks to have happened. In Odom, the arrestee was described as irate and shouting in close proximity to an officer. And in Sindelweck, the conduct was described. That actually took place in the arrestee's yard or a family member's yard, much like this case. And the conduct was described as threatening, combative, irate, and in close proximity. And
okay, but in Sindelweck was what I thought it was very important to the court that he was right up in his face, like, you know, doing physical gestures.
He did point in the officer's face. In this case, Officer Birchfield testified, and Mr. Brooks doesn't dispute, that at the time Mr. Brooks was shouting and screaming these things at him, he was so close that he was reading Officer Birchfield was reading Mr. Brooks' cell phone, the text messages. Birchfield testified that this all happened. He said these things as I was reading the text messages on his cell phone, putting them in close proximity, and that's another fact that's been undisputed by Mr. Brooks.
In the cases you described for us, did the officer immediately arrest the person after
yes.
he became disorderly?
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
Is that distinguishable from this case?
I don't believe
a period of time passed. Why didn't your officer arrest us?
Well,
and immediately. I think that question has been asked, but I'd like to hear you say it.
Well, number one, Mr. Brooks didn't hear or perceive the arrest order, and he retreated or went into his home. And in the city of West Point, it's a policy to call for backup and officer before going into a home to make an arrest. And Officer Birchfield testified that he wanted backup, and he even moved his car into a defensive position because, and I believe his words were, he didn't know what Mr. Brooks was going to come out with next.
Is it the policy of West Point to allow somebody to leave a scene without being arrested after he's become disorderly and committed a disorderly offense crime?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I would not think that's a policy, but I think the point is that however it happened, Mr. Brooks was able to get away, and he'd already committed the crime of disorderly conduct in Mr. Birchfield's, Sergeant Birchfield's view, and was subject to an arrest at that point. And I think that was a reasonable view. If Officer Birchfield had access and made reference to the disorderly conduct statute and the cases interpreting it, I think he would have seen conduct just like or even lesser than he witnessed from Mr. Brooks.
Well, that's why I'm asking the question. It seemed to me he should have arrested him if we're to believe that the man had committed a disorderly offense.
Well, he intended to. He just called for backup first to make sure that he would have help in making the arrest.
I guess the follow-up question that I if the incident's already taken place and it's over with because it seems like they went their separate ways, whatever happened, is it then the process to go out and file a complaint and get a warrant and come back and arrest them with a warrant? The crime, policeman can arrest someone in the process of seeing them commit a crime, and the policeman has probable cause to arrest. But has the crime already been completed and there would be a requirement to go file a complaint and get an arrest warrant and come back and arrest them for the incident that took place?
I have not reviewed that issue carefully, Your Honor, but I would think it'd be no different than an officer who witnesses a theft in a getaway and could call in for backup and chase the subject into a home or anywhere else he were to go to after he's been told, stop, I'm going to put you under arrest.
So your position is that the officers felt that he had an intent when he came out cussing at them, he had the intent to breach the peace?
That goes to encounter number two, which if the court's...
Well, but sticking with the first encounter, in order to describe that as actionable disorderly conduct, you would have to show that the officer believed he was breaching the peace or about to, right? Odom says it isn't ever based on solely words. It has to involve conduct and combative gestures. So to prevail, you've got to be able to say it's undisputed in this record that in addition to his curse words, he agrees, his version of facts does not dispute, that there were combative physical gestures. And you think that's undisputed on this record?
And are you speaking of encounter number one?
Well,
both encounters, because I can speak to both.
No, so far, your position has just been on encounter one. I didn't look at this case that way, but I'd like to play out your theory of the case.
And in,
So is it undisputed that there were combative physical gestures in encounter one, yes or no?
The answer to your question is, I suppose, yes, and the combative physical gestures would be his loud escalation of anger in close proximity to the officer, to the point where the officer didn't know if or was under the belief that he was about to breach the peace.
Your best case for higher volume words equaling physical gestures is what?
That he is in close proximity to the officer. That's the record at 740. The record at 737 is he was hollering at the top of his lungs.
Physical gestures. You're relying on proximity and volume. That's fine. I just want to identify what's not disputed in this record.
Yes, the proximity of his body to the officer with the escalated anger and irate shouting of words that are slightly disputed but not too much.
Okay.
That's encounter number one. Moving forward, the district court analyzed the case not so much based on encounter number one, but as the court pointed out, based on encounter number two, the point at which Officer Spradling had arrived. They approached the house. Officer Birchfield knocked on the front door after having moved his police cruiser into a defensive position, and Mr. Brooks bolts from the side door. And at that point, the court concluded that there was no question that a disorderly conduct charge could be supported based on the actions of Mr. Brooks at that point. It was said earlier that those actions are heavily disputed, but these are the undisputed facts about encounter number two as testified to by Gregory Brooks and his wife Jacqueline Brooks. I'm going to quote Mr. Brooks. He said, "The whole picture is blurry after the knock on the door." That's the record at 296. The knock on the door, he said, put him in a state of shock. That's 288. He said, "I felt like he was back in Iraq again," at 287. He said, "I thought Iraqis were everywhere." By Iraqis, I mean enemy combatants. That's 289. Mr. Brooks testified that he was panicked. That's 289. He testified that he was upset, and he testified that his intent was that he was trying to keep his family safe. When he testified about bolting through the door, his quote was, "I was moving fast, and I ran into Officer Spradling."
He said that?
He did.
"I ran into him?"
At 287, Your Honor, "I ran into Officer Spradling." In her description of that same moment, his wife, Jacqueline Brooks, testified that Mr. Brooks was, that he was moving swiftly, running through the door, that he appeared fearful, that he was not himself. This is 593, 594. That he was upset, that's at 597, and her quote at 337 and 597 was that Mr. Brooks had snapped at that moment. Mr. Brooks testified that he could not dispute lunging at Officer Birchfield in the arrest sequence. That's the record at 293. He testified, "I didn't have control over myself." That's the record at 510. He testified that he could not dispute saying things like, "I'm going to get y'all and you're going to pay for this." That's 292 and 293. And he also cannot dispute in the moment being told, "You're going to be arrested for disorderly conduct," by Officer Birchfield. That's at 292. And Your Honor, we agree with the district court that it is hard to imagine how this conduct does not create a reasonable belief that a breach of the peace is imminent. If as the court said, we're to analyze the case and the conduct at the moment of the arrest, I think this more than satisfies the statute, the disorderly conduct statute, as well as the cases that interpret it. And I'll add that there is an undisputed, the standard is whether any reasonable officer would have made the arrest under the same or similar circumstances. And we have an undisputed expert report, the record at 345, by the former, was at the time, the chief of the Jackson, Mississippi Police Department, who testified that under the same circumstances, he would have done the exact same thing and that the arrest was proper in his view. There is no both episodes. He says it about both episodes. And that's an undisputed expert report that's in the record from a person we think is definitely a reasonable officer, or at least was before he retired. As to excessive force, because I'm close to being out of time, I'll address that briefly.
Am I right that we assess an excessive force case and a false arrest case both based on the arrest, not prior conduct? You both briefed it slightly differently, but I've looked at it that way throughout.
My understanding is for the excessive force claim, you assume the arrest was proper.
You do. So,
And then what you do on qualified immunity is citing City of Shreveport versus Poole is you look at whether there was an injury, whether it resulted directly and only from a use of force that was clearly excessive, and whether the excessiveness of the force was clearly unreasonable. And again, it's the plaintiff's burden to prove the objective unreasonableness of the force used. The undisputed testimony, the record evidence, again, is that, of course, I've already been through the bolting through the door, the view that Mr. Brooks believed Iraqi enemy combatants were present, that he was trying to protect his family. He had lost control of himself. His wife said he had snapped. He ran into Officer Spradling. And then that brings us to the point where, as Your Honor pointed out, Mr. Spradling attempted to conduct the seizure, to commence with the seizure. When Mr. Spradling put his hands on Mr. Brooks, it's undisputed that Mr. Brooks pulled his hand away. That's the record at 290. And he also, as Sergeant Birchfield was approaching to assist in the arrest, extended his hands in some manner. It's disputed whether that was defensive or offensive. However, it's undisputed that his hands impacted the chest of Officer Birchfield, causing him to stumble. Birchfield's been described as charging toward Mr. Brooks, and Mr. Brooks says that, or at least his counsel has argued that it was believed that he was going to be tackled or that Birchfield would strike him. However, that didn't happen. That story ends with Birchfield simply stumbling and then attempting to assist Spradling in grabbing both arms and continuing their attempt to get the cuffs on Gregory Brooks. Mr. Brooks said, "They were pulling me both ways." That's the record at 291, but his quote was, "They couldn't ever get me down." That's also at 291. He said he was standing up, indicating standing up against the officer's efforts. That's at 291. And his family said, it's undisputed, they told him, well, they say, they admit, they said, "Just lay down," indicating that they needed for Mr. Brooks to submit to the officer.
Your time's running out. Are you relying on our Ramirez decision at all or not? There wasn't probable cause to arrest because he was resisting an arrest with an ill-defined basis at the outset?
Not exactly, Your Honor. That's not really what I'm relying on. I'm really just looking at what the court has called the measured and ascending actions in response to the escalating resistance of Mr. Brooks. And I'll close by saying, when you look at the fact that after he let himself down and they laid him on the ground and cuffed him, and he admits they stood him up slowly and let him get on his feet at 292, that it begs the question, what lesser measures could these officers have used and still completed the arrest of Gregory Brooks? Of course, they took him not to the jail but to the hospital for treatment, which I think also speaks to their mindset and what they were trying to do. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask that the summary judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. How do you pronounce your name?
Fletches.
Yeah. These people didn't know each other, right, before this?
They knew of each other but did not really.
Pardon?
They knew of each other but did not really know each other that well.
They did. Of any reputation that Mr. Brooks had for being a...
No evidence of any reputation, Your Honor.
Veteran who had problems or...
But no one knew that. He was very private about that. And his PTSD came from seeing a child get hit by a truck when he was in Baghdad, and they were on a convoy mission. So it's not, he is not, in order to get where they want you to get on the PTSD and the Iraqis and the enemy combatants, which was all words that were put into his mouth during the deposition, you've got to draw inferences in their favor. You can't get to he did physical conduct from that. You have to, but a couple of things really quickly. Judge Dennis was right on point in Freeman versus Gore, where he plainly stated, yelling and screaming does not take conduct outside the level of speech. That is right on point in this. As far as this going on while he was in close proximity to Mr. Brooks, the quote from the record is not true. He was not reading the phone. He read the phone before, and the actual quote about the proximity from Officer Birchfield himself is, and when I was talking to him, you know, we was just like, you know, just, you know, pretty much talking close together.
But this was on his, in his lawn, in his yard, his property?
Exactly.
Did it draw a crowd? Were there other people there listening to what was being said?
Not a soul around except for Officer Birchfield and Mr. Brooks, which means that Mr. Brooks' words could not be seen as inciting others to breach the peace, which is really what the disorderly conduct is designed to. It's a civil rights era statute, and it was designed to control protests. It was designed to keep others from inciting others to breach the peace against the police officers. But you can't stretch Officer Birchfield's quote that he was talking, you know, pretty much talking close together into he was screaming in my face. You can't be stretched to that. And even if he was, screaming and yelling does not amount to speech. And to hear the defense argument, you would think that they're saying because he maybe had a mistaken but good faith belief that he was arresting him and have probable cause to arrest, the cases are replete that subjective good faith in an arrest doesn't matter. You have to look at whether a reasonable officer.
Mississippi is trying to find a line between fighting words, breach of peace.
And I'll show you the line, Your Honor.
Okay.
The line is, could the officer leave without escalating the situation? That is in Odom, that is in Sendwick. Both of those cases noted that the officer could not leave that situation safely. Odom took place in the sheriff's department. Officer Birchfield testified that there was nothing impeding him from leaving. Obviously, he went to his car.
That's a strange rule. You may be right. That's Mississippi law. That assumes the cops have to always retreat?
Not in a dangerous situation, just like in Sendwick. Because the Sendwick officer said, at any minute, we was fixing to fight. That was his quote, which means he can't turn his back on that situation. Not only could Officer Birchfield have done so, he did do so. He got in his car. And Judge Prado, you were exactly right. What the proper thing to do if he thought he had probable cause for an arrest would be to go to a judge and get a warrant. They had no business knocking on the door, no matter what door Mr. Brooks answered their call. They had no business knocking on that door. They knocked on the door for the sole purpose of making an arrest. The arrest was initiated before that, and it was without probable cause and obviously based upon nothing more than speech. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, sir.